everybody. Welcome to the Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Thanks for joining. We have a live in-studio guest today. We're going to be talking with Chris Pelletieri and a student of his named Arissa about stone carving in an age of robots. I'm going to bring Chris and Arissa on mic momentarily, but first let me say why I brought them on to talk about stone carving, since that is a topic that I haven't ever covered on the show. I have done a couple of shows, and I'm going to make the connection. You'll see the connection here shortly. I've done a couple of shows on AI-generated music, most recently last week's show with WFMU station manager Ken Friedman. We played on that show a bunch of AI-generated songs, some of them terrible, like a version of a Beatles song played in the style of Queen. That was the supposed design of that file, anyway. Other songs we played, I'll admit, were more interesting, like the large language song called The Momus of Meningiga Thistle. If you missed that one, that's worth taking a listen to. And during that conversation, a company called Suno came up, S-U-N-O. This is a startup that makes generative AI audio, what I like to call extruded musical product. And Suno, as well as other musical generators online using AI, they ask you to type in a prompt, like, I don't know, it could be upbeat country song with lyrics about shopping in the supermarket, and add some violence, which, by the way, is one of the songs we played in that show. And when you enter that prompt in the right way and maybe revise it a few times, then out comes a piece of musical glop conforming to whatever you requested in your prompt. Well, the obvious flaw in this is that actual musicians are not participating in the creation of this music, except for perhaps having their own songs ripped off and plagiarized in the training of these AI models. And it raises the question of what kind of future we're headed into if people's audio streams are going to be flooded with this kind of AI-generated dreck with no direct human artistry or craftsmanship involved. And it just so happens that a few days ago, the co-founder of Suno, a guy named Mikey Shulman, went on a Tech Booster podcast to talk about his company, Suno, and how it works and what it does and the business model and all about AI-generated music and so on. This was a podcast called 20VC, hosted by a guy named Harry Stebbings, who is himself a venture capitalist. And what I want to do is I want to play an excerpt of this 20VC conversation, because I think it illuminates exactly what people are concerned about, what I just tried to describe in terms of AI-generated music routing around human artistry and craftsmanship, which is going to tie directly into our conversation with Chris and Arissa about stone carving here in a couple of minutes. So again, this is from a few days ago on the 20VC podcast with Suno co-founder Mikey Shulman. Here it is.
We didn't just want to build, let's say, a company that makes the current crop of creators 10% faster or makes it 10% easier to make music. If you want to impact the way a billion people experience music, you have to build something for a billion people. And so that is first and foremost giving everybody the joys of creating music. And this is a huge departure from how it is now. It's not really enjoyable to make music now. People enjoy
it. Why did you say that?
It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of practice. You need to get really good at an instrument or really good at a piece of production software. I think the majority of people don't enjoy the majority of the time they spend making music.
Do you not think that's like running? It is hard to run. It is painful to run. You don't particularly enjoy it, but you love running. And you get good at it, and you get better at it, and you speak to the runners, and they love running.
Most people drop out of that pursuit because it was hard. And so I think that the people that you know that run, this is a highly biased selection of the population that fell in love with it.
I'm jumping back and forth.
Okay, so that was the 20 VC podcast. And again, we have Mikey Shulman, co-founder of Suno, this AI-generated music company, saying, in essence, people don't like learning a new instrument. They don't like developing craftsmanship. They don't like making music because of all of the work it takes. I mean, it's hard for me even to recite the argument that he's trying to make without laughing because it is so ridiculous. Now, I understand why an executive from a startup, a tech booster, is trying to boost his own technology, but that just is such a terrible argument to try to sell people on getting excited about your technology by saying something that's so clearly false for anyone who loves music or likes developing any kind of skill, which is why I wanted to play that in introduction to our conversation this evening about another skill that takes a long time to learn and pays great dividends in life, and that is stone carving. And I want to say at the outset, I know very, very little about stone carving. So good thing I'm the host and not the guest. But I'm coming at this with an open mind, and I'm really happy to welcome our two guests this evening. Chris Pelletieri is the founder of Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy, which is based in New York City, and a student of his, Arissa, is with us as well. Chris and Arissa, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks, Mark. It's
Hi.
Great to be here.
Chris, get right up on the mic, right up on the mic.
Okay. I'm going to give Suno a break because it's a little, I'm a little anxious being on the radio too, so maybe that was part of his problem.
Let me try a different mic. I feel like you're not on. Can you say hello, Chris?
Hi, Mark.
You're still not on. We're going to need to get you right up on the mic.
Okay. Is that better?
How about going over to Arissa's mic, and how about the two of you share this mic? I think this is going to be better for us.
Is this better?
Say again, Chris.
Hi, Mark. Is this better?
Much better.
Oh, yeah. I can hear myself in my headphones now.
Okay, so you can just take turns, Arissa and Chris, okay. at mic two. You're both going to sound great on it. So, Chris, welcome to the show. I wanted to start by asking you to just give us a little introduction to you. You've been a stone carver for decades, and of course, you're the founder of Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy. So tell us about you and the academy.
Okay, yeah. I grew up in Manhattan near the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, which is an enormous stone building, unfinished. And I even went to elementary school in a school that was a close part of the cathedral. So I was around in 1979 when they resumed construction. They hadn't done any construction since World War II.
For listeners who aren't familiar with that part of the Upper West Side, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine is a Gothic cathedral, which, when completed, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I understand it's going to be the largest Gothic cathedral in the world.
That's what they say, yeah.
So it is, even today, in its perpetually unfinished state, if you walk through, it's an amazing space.
Yeah.
And it's 112th Street, if anyone wants to go up and take a look at it.
Yeah, Amsterdam Avenue. And another important thing about it is it's built load-bearing stone. It's not like a steel structure with stone kind of veneer. It's more like the ancient way of building with stone. Anyway, I was there. I was only 12 years old, but I was there when they resumed construction, and they couldn't find any people who knew how to do this craft anymore because the whole industry had withered, and so they had to get people from Europe to come to New York City and train local people.
Just back off. You're good. Okay,
right.
So they needed to bring people in from Europe a bit.
Uh-huh. And it was celebrated. It was in the news, and it was tremendously exciting thing. But I wasn't only 12 years old, so I went to high school and college and really did my best at academic pursuits, but then felt pretty burned out after college and discovered I really like working with tools and making things, working with materials. And at that point, I remembered what I had seen at the cathedral, and I went back and I became an apprentice. And for 2 years, I learned these ancient traditional techniques. And I mean, before that, I was pretty pessimistic, even like in dreading a future where I wouldn't really like what I was doing. But after becoming an apprentice, I really felt optimistic, and there was enough work at the cathedral basically to keep people busy for the rest of their lives. But unfortunately, after 2 years, they started embracing some mechanization, and these ancient traditional techniques that I was learning were kind of replaced by, not like the robots that we have today, but something that did 90% of the work automatically, and then the workers had to clean it up and fix it up and get the parts that the robot couldn't reach, you know, so the work became dreadful. And I was so excited about what I was learning that I wanted to continue, and I quit. And shortly after that, they closed down anyway. So I became independent, and for about 25 years, I was a solitary, independent, freelance stone carver, and doing commissions and things, and trying to increase my skill and challenge myself and learn more and more as I had been in the cathedral. So, and then about 10 years ago, I decided to start focusing a lot of my energy on promoting stone carving and training people and helping other people have the same kind of experience that I'd had and discover the same kinds of fulfilling and meaningful and work they could be proud of, and using hands and materials in a way that was really not many people are doing anymore.
And so you're focused on, as you say, the ancient ways of carving stone. You're not using any robots. You're not using the kind of mechanized tools that were being used at that time at the cathedral.
Right. I use some power tools. I'm not saying I'm a purely hand power person, probably about 75% hand power, but I use electric drills and pneumatic air hammer. But I don't use anything that you set up and walk away from and it does the work for you.
So whatever is being used in the workshop, you're managing it right there on site.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Arissa, let's hear from you. How long have you been stone carving?
I would say about 2.5 years. I found Chris through a high school program. And since I liked art, I decided to do a 2-week program during the summer. And there was a lot of options. There was stone carving, neon lighting, glass blowing. I put stone carving as my number one choice because that's everything that you see in shows. Like, they're always doing stone carving. In SpongeBob, there's that scene where he's stone carving. And since I was young, that was, like, something I wanted to do. And I took the 2-week program during the summer, and it was really, really fun and eye-opening. And I had these two pieces at the end of the program that I thought looked amazing. And after that, the next year after, Chris invited me again to help, this time with kids. Well, I was older, but same 2-week program, and I was helping them. And I also got to make another piece of my own. And then later on after that, during September, he asked me to work on my own pieces. So since then, I've been working on my own pieces. And I'm still working on my own pieces, and they're taking time. But I go each week, once a week, to work on my own pieces, and I love everything that's going on so far.
Now, thank you for that background, Arissa. You just said that you love working on these pieces, and that stands in great contrast to what the Tech Bros were talking about earlier, or just one of them, I should say, was the Suno guy was saying that musicians don't like going through the work and the pain and the time and the effort of learning a new instrument. Are you saying that you actually have enjoyed the learning process of stone carving?
You know, it's really funny, but yes, I do. At sometimes it can get hard. So at that point, I guess I can understand what he's saying, but art in general is to create. So why would you put something AI? Why would you say something like that when people take their time and learn all of that in order to create?
What has your experience been in the learning process? Did you feel like you had to struggle through it, or was it fun? Were there ups and downs? What did it feel like going through those 2.5 years to learn up to the point where you are now?
In the beginning, it's new, so it's fun. But as the more I do it, there has been, because the things I choose have been more difficult now than they were when we first started off, there are more ups and downs. I had to take some time away and move on to a different piece, and then come back to that same thing, because in stone carving there's like more than one way of thinking about making art. There's the stone itself, where you have to break away everything, and then there's the more technical aspect. And when you're stuck on one side, like where you're just breaking apart everything, that's one part of the brain, and then there's that really where you have to take the time and look away from all of the references you've made and just look at the piece and zone in onto what you want to make out of it. So you it's a lot. But I enjoy doing it. At the end of the day, I enjoy doing it, and I want to do that part, all of it.
It sounds like it's almost meditative for you to zone in on the piece and focus just on that one thing.
It is. I didn't realize that it was meditative until me and Chris did, what was it? We did a, what's that thing called? We went to the Met and we did a demonstration. And there was a lady there, and I was teaching her how to use the tools. And she said, oh, this is very meditative. And then it clicked for me, and I was like, yeah, it is. Because when I go there, I go for like 4 or 5 hours, and I zone in on the piece.
Wow.
And... well, Chris obviously does way more than me, but I zone in on the piece and the time just flies by, and then I come in next week and it flies by, and it just flies by, and it's just zoning in and taking time away from online, TikTok, everything. So I don't know why you'd put AI to do those things, but...
Well, Chris, I want to ask you how your pedagogical goals are designed. I mean... are you designing the program for young talents like Arissa to have the kind of experience that she's describing? What are you trying to lead them into?
Well, my main concern is stone carving, but I think a lot of what I do applies to any kind of traditional craft where people are working with material, be it metal, wood, leather, glass, whatever, because those are the things that I wanted. Working with your hands in general is something that I want to try to promote and bring back. But when it comes to stone carving, the way I was trained was we did the very most basic process first, and it wasn't even a work of art. It was just we had a block of stone, and they drew a pencil line around the top, and they just said, take down the surface to this pencil line. Everything above the pencil line you get rid of, everything below the pencil line, optimally, you don't break. And that's a really... great way to learn just to get skill with the tools. And I'm always telling the students, you know, it's like you don't want to have like you don't want to have it be too precious. You want to feel like it's a piece of scrap, because you can experiment and take chances, and if it comes out, you know, not so great, you're not going to feel like, oh, my masterpiece is ruined.
Right.
People always begin to get feel it's precious, even if it's just a flat surface, after a couple hours, because a couple hours is a long time to work on one thing for a lot of people. Before I started with stone, the most time I spent on anything was like a research paper in school, was maybe like 15 hours of work, you know, if you squished it all together, but yeah, spread out over weeks. So here I was in the cathedral spending like 8-hour days for weeks, you know, on one piece of stone. So it really, that's another great thing about working with materials, especially stone, is because you really see what you're capable of. And I don't want to disrespect any other kind of work, especially really important kinds of work, but it's rare that you get to see the cumulative impact of your effort and energy in one single piece of thing.
So what do you say to... and I don't want to keep hammering on this one guy from Suno. I'm just using him as an example of some broader thinking that's coming at us from Silicon Valley, that if we would all just allow Silicon Valley to build us the automated systems where we can tap or push a button or swipe or what have you, our lives are going to get so much easier. They have this theory that all of us outside of Silicon Valley want some kind of ease surrounded by screens. What's your answer to that?
I can totally, you know, without vilifying Suno, I can totally relate to how that is kind of an image of the future, of progress, that kind of we feel like we've been kind of expecting since we were kids watching the Jetsons, is that, like, you push buttons and things get done for you. That's like progress. But it wasn't until I started working with Stone that I realized, you know, hard work, it's kind of got a bad name. It's like hard work can be really rewarding. I mean, if you're in sports or if you put your kids in sports, you know, oh, of course, hard work. The coach is always like, you're a hard worker. That's so good. It's rewarded. But it seems like there's a flip side where people are like, oh, that's such hard work. You know, I wish I had let's come up with a machine that'll do that for us. Or if it really takes a lot of skill, let's come up with a machine that'll do that for us. But once I started working with Stone, I realized I kind of like hard work when it's, and that doesn't mean, you know, my wife is going to be waiting for me. Well, you like hard work. We got all these clothes that need to be folded. Right. So, yeah, I mean, careful. It's not so clear like that right. All the time I like hard work, but when you find something you like to do, you find yourself working really hard at it. And if you love golf, you probably work really hard at it. If you love, I don't know, an instrument, you're going to work really hard at it. And so I give Suno a break to some extent by saying, like, yeah, certain kinds of work we want to avoid.
Sure.
Drudgery or you know, but dangerous stuff.
Yes.
But I really love what I do, and I'm really glad I get to do it, and I get to share it with other people, and that's part of my mission, is I want to share it with people and help them realize, you know, why would you want a machine that would do that for you?
That's right. So we have Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy that focuses on the manual work of stone carving. There are some power tools for certain steps, but even then, you're involved.
You're guiding it completely, right.
And even that's a minority of the work. The majority of it is, I don't even know the names of the tools. What are some of the tools?
Hammer, chisel, mallets.
Claw.
You mean like a gouge. That's like a wood tool. I see your gesture is like scooping.
Okay, so you don't do that on stone? I know nothing. Thank you. Oh, this way. Yeah. Arissa is showing me the hammering motion. Okay, thank you, Arissa. So those are the tools. And by focusing yourself and your students on manual work that's intentional, as Arissa said, you can reach a meditative state. Over time, you develop a skill. You zone in. I like that phrase that you used, Arissa. Zone in on one piece of work, and then in the end, you have something that you're really proud of. So there, it seems to me that there are a lot of benefits to the craftspeople themselves. Right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't do anything really technological with the computer, but I wonder if, like, people who do coding, I wonder if they zone in. They probably zone in. And kids in high school robotics class, my school, high school, had robotics class. Most of the, like, advanced schools have robotics clubs.
Yeah.
They probably love it partly because they're working with tools and making things and
developing a skill and a lot of those same benefits, working hard.
I'm not sure they realize that the whole robotics, you know, culture is about depriving other people of those kinds of pleasures.
Yeah. Well, let's, on that note, because now that we've established the benefits to the stone carvers themselves, I want to play an excerpt, just about a minute. What is it? It's about a minute, a little more than a minute, from a recent 60 Minutes broadcast where they sent a journalist over to Italy to see something called Robo. This is a robot made by a company called Robotour that is a stone carving robot. And you'll hear in the coverage, in this little clip, how it works. And then we can talk about robotics in stone carving. And again, this is from 60 Minutes a little while ago. Here it is.
Meet Robo, one of the brigade of robots taking over sculpture. We watched as Leonardo da Vinci's trademark hat was adjusted, not with a hammer and chisel, but a 13-foot zinc alloy arm and a spinning diamond-crusted finger. Water jets kept Leonardo cool. This was a week's work for Robo, with another two to go.
So if you were doing this the old-fashioned way, hammer and chisel, how long would this take?
10 times more, at least.
10 times longer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Massari told us his mechanical employees, 7 and counting, don't sleep, get sick, or take holidays. He took robots off the automotive line and gave them bigger brains.
And the robot will work all these ridges.
Robotour's chief technician, also a sculptor, turns the artist's model into a 3D file. That generates a complex set of instructions that tells the robot exactly where to carve, right down to the last half inch.
All right, so again, that was 60 Minutes covering Robo, the robotic stone carving machine made by a company called Robotour, and you heard how it works. The I don't know what to call them, the agents, the engineers, the designers, the human will input a 3D file into the robot, and then it uses its diamond saw or whatever and water cooling, and takes a few hours, and there's 90% of the work done. And then later in the piece, they do say that human stone carvers come in and do some of the details. So there is some human work to be done. But it is a completely different approach from beginning to end from what you're talking about, Arissa and Chris. What's your reaction when you hear the 60 Minutes piece? How does that make you feel? What comes to mind when you hear about a robot doing 90% of the stone carving work?
Well, when I think of AI and this robot, I just think about who asked. I just wonder who asked for it, because nobody in the art world, in my opinion, all the people that I know, nobody wanted AI in art. I feel like they could put the AI to something else useful, like medicine, go help cancer, let the AI figure out cancer. I feel like art is something that should have human interaction, should be made from the human mind. Because when you see AI art, I went to the Whitney once and I saw AI art on the wall. It didn't look good. I don't know why it was there. It didn't look good. They just typed in, I don't know, girl with braids on clouds. And it was the biggest thing there, and I did not like it. So when I hear of this robot and its arm sawing, it's just, who asks for it? And is it really going to look that good? I mean, there's just something, when you buy art, you just want that human touch in it. So I don't agree with it, but.
Good answer. Who asked for it? Who asked for it anyway? I've asked that as well on past shows. Who asked for this and who is it for, really? Now, I think that the sculptors would say, just having watched the whole piece, there were some stone carvers there who were saying, no, we're not abdicating, we're not sending everything over to an AI. It's just doing basically the majority of the prep work for us, and then we come in and put the human touch at the end. Chris, what do you think about that? What do you think about the stone carvers, and maybe you know some of them in that piece, where they're saying, this is actually benign, nothing to worry about, because the humans are still involved?
I don't really think it's, for me, productive to think about the product. I don't want to think about the product. Stone carving so close to me that it wouldn't be fair. But if there was some product that I really needed, I just needed it, but I didn't really care if it was like top level or anything, and the robot version was cheaper, I'd probably get the robot version. But my focus is not on the product, as on the experience. I don't train people in stone carving primarily because I think their product is going to change the world. I train them in stone carving because of what it does for them internally. They're the product. So, you know, if it's a robot carving stone, there is no internal product. There's an external product. And if I was building a casino and I wanted 50 Roman gods you know, in togas to sort of decorate the place, you know where you're going to get humans to work that fast. So, yeah, getting a robot makes sense. But I do because I love it, and I teach people because I think they'll love it too, not because of the product, but because of how fulfilling it is to do. That doesn't mean like they could just throw all the product away. I like the idea that it's going to last and people will see it. But when you talk about the robot's product and compare it to like a human-made product, that just seems like an argument that goes nowhere, because there's so much human-made art that's undeniably, at least by today's standards, it's art, but it's total garbage. So like the title of art to me is like, well, that's not like some honor to bestow and withhold from a robot or a human. It can still be art. It could still be something that could decorate a place where nobody even really cares what it is. I assume that's probably most of the destinations that they're going to are places where people just want to decorate and they don't really care.
Right.
But the whole thing to me is the experience and how fulfilling it is and how much it makes people happy to work with their hands and to be creative, something people have been doing for 100,000 years, but in the last 200 years, it's kind of been driven to the margin. Only a lucky few get to work with their hands.
That's right. If you're just joining us, listeners, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining 20-plus minutes of the show. We are speaking with two live in-studio guests today. We've got Chris Pelletieri, who's the founder of the Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy, and a student of Chris's named Arissa is also here, and they're talking about the rewards and the benefits and the joys of stone carving, and in Arissa's case, learning how to stone carve, how to carve stone over the last 2.5 years. I'm learning myself. If you want links to Chris's Academy and or any of the other items that I have brought up this evening, go to tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And you'll see the playlist link for the Chris Pelletieri episode about stone carving. If you are listening outside the New York area, I want to remind you that you can ask your local independent radio station to syndicate Tectonic simply by emailing me, mark@wfmu.org, or syndication@wfmu.org. We've got some new stations to welcome to the fold, which I'll get to in a subsequent episode. But we are growing the family of stations carrying Tectonic and hearing these discussions. So welcome to everybody who is listening outside of the New York, New Jersey area. Chris, going back to what you just said, I really like that you're bringing up this eternal question of what is art, and you're saying how hard that is to answer. What does it matter if someone looks at a product and says this is art or this isn't, or I judge it this way? You're saying that your benchmark of quality is what your experience was, or what your students' experience was in putting the work in and learning the process of carving the stone to get it to that point. That's what makes it meaningful to you.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's a benchmark of quality that I would judge the product by. Like sometimes an artist might like really have a unpleasant experience making something, but maybe I'd love it and I think it was a great piece of art. So, but that's how I judge whether I'm successful as a teacher or whether I'm successful, as a carver. Sometimes I get paid for my commissions, so
sure.
It's whether I enjoy it or not. Sometimes that's not really a standard of success, but.
But this brings up the one person in this whole transaction or relationship that we haven't talked much about up to this point, and that is the customer or the buyer or the person viewing the carved stone, the carving. If someone, and as I think you alluded to, most people are not going to have the eye that both of you have for carvings. They're going to go out and they're going to look at a sculpture, and they won't have the years of experience that you
and
have.
And even with my eye and experience, probably in 10 or 20 years, they'll be making machines so advanced that, I wouldn't be able to tell.
Okay, so here it is. So we've got Robo is doing 90% of the work over there in Italy now, but as they said in the 60 Minutes piece, maybe in a few years it'll be 95%, 99%, and at some point it may be indistinguishable. This, by the way, is the same conversation that we're having about music, AI-generated music, musical extruded product, AI-generated art, you know, static art, the kind of which you saw at the Whitney, Arisa, and even there are new tools. Facebook has one, and there are some others out there that AI-generate video. And those are very rudimentary right now, but give it a few years, they're always... So what happens when, if and when we get to a point in society where all of the items and media artifacts on our screens and physically, even the stone carvings, are made by AI-powered tools rather than artisans or humans who have some sort of artistic vision? How do you feel about that possible future, Chris?
Well, yeah, that's a pretty depressing one. It's a pretty depressing future. But I mean, in terms of stone carving, which is my main passion, a lot of people already living in that future because they probably live in communities where, not like New York City, where there are buildings, you know, 150 years old that have hand-carved stone. It might be, you know, a whole community, the oldest building in the community might be 40 years old. So they don't know what hand-shaped, I mean, in this room, this console, there's some paintings made by hand, but there's a lot of rooms we spend time in where there's nothing that's made by hand. And that's pretty sad. And the idea that kids wouldn't have any kind of insight into the possibility of working with your hands, and everything's on the phone or on a screen, or there's just no promotion. Nobody's making money out of promoting working with your hands. Right. So it's invisible. It's already really hard. That's my mission, is to promote it, first of all, and once people know what it is, to offer them an opportunity to try it and learn it and get good at it. But first, to even show people that, look, oh my God, there's somebody working with his hands, making something with hand tools and materials. It's like, that's really important to me, that kids would be able to see that. And it's not guaranteed that that's going to be able to, you know, be in people's future much longer. Yeah.
Arisa, I want to ask you, you mentioned that you're not on the phone, obviously, when you are carving the stone. When you leave the academy and go back home, or you hang out with friends, what do your friends say when they hear about your stone carving adventures?
I don't know. I feel like I keep it hush hush. I think they think it's cool. I think they ask about it. I usually show them what I do, and they're like, whoa. I have all the pieces in the backyard as decoration, and I really like it. I wish more people would want to do it.
Have any of your friends expressed interest in joining you in the school?
I think most of the people I tell aren't artists, so they wouldn't technically be the first people to come and say, oh, I want to do it. But I think they do if they had the opportunity, they would try it at least. Like, if I had the tools at home and I had a piece of stone and I said, do you want to try doing this? They'd be like, yeah, of course. My boyfriend, he's tried doing it before, and that was pretty funny to watch. And one time, it was fun, but yeah.
So, Chris, what do you think is the future outside of passing this along to the next generation, outside of the very real benefits of teaching this to younger talented people like Arisa? If someone out there is thinking of getting involved in a manual art, is there a way to make a living long term when the robots are advancing on all, you know, not just stone but everything else?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when I started the Academy, it's a nonprofit. It's a, you know, 501c3, and I would approach people for donations. One of my first angles was like, it's a job training program. But I never really felt very good about that because I struggle to find work, and I've been doing it for 36 years. So that's kind of dishonest, and I've stopped doing it. But I'm unapologetic, about still believing that it's a worthwhile thing for people to donate money to, because, I mean, people put their kids in Little League not with the expectation that they're going to become professional baseball players. They give them music lessons not with the expectation that they'll be playing in Carnegie Hall or in some professional orchestra. It's just a recognition that those kinds of paths, those kinds of pursuits really improve kids' lives, unless they're being forced and they really don't want to do it. But if they're into it, even if they don't have the kind of talent that they'd need to make it as a professional, as a profession, it's really benefits their lives and something that'll help them when they go to do other things. You know, they'll learn about focus, they'll learn about concentrating, they'll learn about the kind of optimal attitude for learning through stone carving, and then they'll carry that to something else. Yeah.
And I think there, I would argue that humanity needs to keep these skills alive so that we don't forget them, so that we don't lose when this generation passes away, that the knowledge just doesn't disappear. It reminds me of a conversation I had a year or two ago with a guy named Paul Salopek, who's he's a National Geographic explorer, and he's walking across the globe. You've heard of this guy. Fascinating, and just a great, what an inspiring story. And last time, he's been on the show a couple times. The last time he was on the show, we were talking about his most recent segment of his walk was through Southwest China, where there are many traditional farmers who use these ancient processes for farming on hillsides. And there are big rains, and there's all kinds of weather events, and they have figured out through the countless generations how to successfully subsist and even thrive despite those challenges in the terrain and the weather there. And he said that the kids of those farmers are now moving to the cities because, like many economies, the Chinese economy is urbanizing. And so a lot of those traditional, indigenous, ancient skills and knowledge sets are disappearing as those farmers retire and die. And Paul gave, I remember him giving this urgent plea at the end of our interview, we have to preserve that knowledge. We have to get out there and talk to the farmers and say, please, could you teach us? Have a conversation with them, not just to extract the knowledge, but to build some community with them so that the human community will retain that knowledge. It just seems that whether it's traditional farming on the hillside of Southwest China or it's carving stone, what you're talking about, these are precious bits of knowledge, whole oceans of knowledge that are going to disappear if we don't try to protect them somehow.
I'm with you 100%, and I think, darn it, I forgot what I was going to say.
Arisa, what do you think about? Are you willing? Can you commit right now? Sorry to put you on the spot.
Oh,
are you gonna? I'm halfway kidding here, but do you feel a sense of responsibility that you are going to be carrying the torch for the next generation? You're one of the few young stone carvers in the country right now.
Okay, that's not a lot of pressure.
Sorry.
No, when I first came to the Stone Carving Academy, I didn't have the intention of doing it long term. But after Chris invited me and I've been doing it for so long, I do feel responsible to keep going. And even if it's not like my profession in the future, just to have it there all the time until, and just pass it on.
Because it's at some point, there's going to be an outage of some kind, and the AI is going to go down, maybe just temporarily, but people are going to suddenly. It's like I always think about that last scene in WALL-E. Did you ever see that movie, WALL-E?
Of course.
Of course. And you remember they finally come us, sorry if you haven't seen it, a bit of a spoiler, but when they come back to Earth and they get off the spaceship, they rediscover all of these skills. And of course, they make it look so easy. They come off and they start agriculture right away. But really, if we don't preserve skill sets and knowledge bases like traditional manual stone carving, when the AI goes out, what are we going to do with stone at that point?
There's only so much a textbook could have in it. There's only so much a textbook could only read. There's at some point you're going to have to do. I'm turning 20 soon, so technically I've been born when computers and iPads and iPods and all that stuff came out. So I know how important it is to keep all of these manual stuff alive still.
Well, you're giving me hope, Arissa, that you see the importance of this. You've put in the focused, concentrated work for over 2 years. You have the skills. You're continuing to develop them. And as you say, even if you're not a full-time stone carver in your career, you're gonna remember and you're gonna maintain those skills. We're gonna need you. So the world is gonna need you. So thank you for doing that. And Chris, thank you for teaching Arissa. Yeah.
I remember what I was going to say, and I'm going to hit you with some Mark Hurst fervor now, maybe at the
okay.
very end.
Okay, good.
Because I've believed that, you know, every animal on the planet has its specific characteristics and attributes and things that it does especially well. Like dolphins can swim incredibly well. Humans can swim too, but dolphins like are in another league. What do humans have that's special? It's like our big brains, our language that we can share information and increase, you know, over generations, and our hands. Our hands are so agile, and we can grasp things and do things really well with our hands. So my comparison between the place where humans are at now with handcrafts is like as if dolphins had decided, like, you know, I'm done, like, flipping around and jumping out of the water. Let's just be like manatees and hang there in the water and wait for stuff to come to us. That's unthinkable. You can't imagine dolphins or any kind of animal, like, changing its behavior so radically. But that's kind of what humans are doing now, because we've had this 100,000 years of history of, like, using our hands to shape materials. And it's like, oh, you shape material. Well, can't we come up with a machine that'll do that? Can't we come up with a robot that can do that? Really, it looks like such hard work. Why would you want to do that?
What are you doing with that guitar?
Exactly, yeah.
Nobody likes playing the guitar.
Can't we come up with a machine for
that? Don't you know, you get calluses on your fingers. They're painful. You might hit the wrong note sometimes, and that make you feel bad. Wouldn't you rather just press a button and then have the guitar music come out of the screen?
Yeah, so all the listeners out there, don't be like dolphins who are living life as manatees. Try to be your true dolphin self.
And listen, if you're a manatee, no letters, please. We love manatees, too. You have your own beautiful essences that we love. But that's such a great analogy, Chris, that every creature has its innate talents, and humans have some, but not others. And hands, I hadn't thought of that. The dexterity and the range of motion and the precision, right? And combined with an artistic mind, that we're able to use our hands to make beautiful objects. And we're gonna let all that disappear and hand it over to a screen?
The crazy part is, I think looking for easier ways to do things is also part of our nature. So like from windmills or water wheels, like, you know, looking for ways to like not sweat so much. So inventing robots is also kind of part of our nature, but we're at a point now, I mean, 40 years ago, that's not gonna put stone carvers out of business. It's just gonna make their lives a little easier. Now we're at a point where, no, actually, maybe it will make stone carving, like, just a complete mystery. Without the machine, we'll be like, oh, I don't know. I don't know how they did that. Like with the pyramids, it's a complete mystery.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like what you said before, that it's worth avoiding drudgery. Nobody wants the boring or maybe dangerous work that is just repetitive, and there's no real artistic benefit to scooping up all of the mud when you could use a backhoe or something like that. So there obviously are some very, very good reasons for leveraging power with automated tools, whether it's construction equipment or, you know, bomb disposal robots. They'll go in and defuse the bomb remotely. Those are all good things. But there has to be, it seems like there has to be some dividing line where we say, over in this area, it's actually a net negative for humanity and our culture and our subsequent generations if we lose these skills. Learning how to play the guitar or piano or whatever instrument is not drudgery. It's worth it on its own. And carving stone as well is itself a worthy activity. Wouldn't you say, Arissa?
I was thinking, right, everything takes a lot of time to do, and it takes hard work to do, but that's the thing. Like, you can't go have a good day without having a bad day. So it's all about, like, balance. And if AI takes over, like, if AI takes over everything, then we don't have anything to do. And everything is just going to become monotonous. Like, we're just going to be living happy life, but that happy life will be draining eventually if we don't have any downfall or anything to, you know, come back up to. If you don't fall, you can't get back up type of mentality.
Okay, that's wisdom, friends. That's wisdom from Arissa. She's not even 20. We have hope. We have hope. Arissa comes to Studio A and there's hope. I'm dead serious, friends. Let's not be grim and depressed all the time that AI is going to take over, because Arissa is out there and she knows about life and what's worth it, and she's continuing to learn how to carve stone. Chris, why don't you tell us how people can get in touch if they're intrigued by the idea of stone carving classes?
Yeah, please feel free to give me a call at 646-229-6418, or go to the website stonecarversacademy.org, and there's a thing that you can click on and send me an email. We have a workspace in the Bronx, and we have classes there. I teach a class at the Complete Sculptor in Manhattan, and most of my students at that place are tech workers who were like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to be able to stand on my feet and swing a hammer and see something happening that's not on a screen. So it's a great antidote if that's, you know, the way you spend a lot of time.
Well, great. Thank you, Chris. And again, as I said before, the links to the Academy and the various pieces we talked about are all on the playlist at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And just click the playlist link and you can do it. I got to get out of here for Dave Mandel, who is no vandal. He's going to be playing his prog rock show called It's Complicated. And I'm just about out of time.
Dave Mandel?
Oh my gosh. Erwin Chusid. I have to apologize, Erwin, because Dave told me that you were coming and then I promptly forgot it. And I was looking forward to seeing you. Friends, it is the great Erwin Chusid. You want to say hi to the nice people?
Hi, Erwin. We were talking about drudgery before, and I remember you talking about how much you love washing dishes.
I do like washing dishes. I don't own a dishwasher.
So that's a good example of drudgery not being always the same for everybody.
I enjoy it.
This is WFMU history right here.
You know, I have something to say.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Arissa. We have just a couple of seconds left.
Oh, okay. We recently switched to using dishwasher over COVID. I want to throw it away. I want to go back to dishwashing because it's not doing its job anymore. It's not.
All right, so we have built a consensus here against dishwashers and against all kinds of robots. I really appreciate Chris Pelletieri and Arissa from the Pelletieri Stone Carvers Academy for joining me on Tectonic this evening. Wish you both the best of luck, and please keep in touch.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I want you to stay tuned for the great Erwin Chusid with his eponymous show. It's going to be a treat. And I have some homework for all of you. Until next time, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Our outro this evening is yet another tune from brother Daniel Blumen, and you'll know why shortly. he chose this. Thank you, Daniel. Have a great week, everybody. Monitor, great store, got to move. Monitor, great store, got to move. Monitor, great store, all in Pompilla. Monitor, great store, got to move. Sing it again, Monitor, great store. To move, yeah. Marada, great store, got to move. Marada, great store, stone in Babylon. Marada, great store, got to move. Real, 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 just so.
The egg. It is the symbol of creation. And since I was your age, it has hatched all my greatest super science ideas.
No windows.
Pay attention, Dean. Now sit down. You're about to meet my muse.
Mommy?
Progressive rock. Now normally I'd start you off with Asia or something more accessible, but I think you're ready for the primo sh**. Just take a gander at that cover art and try to pretend you're not already inspired.
It's like something out of a dream.
Painted by our greatest living artist, Mr. Roger Dean.
Hey, that's my name!
That's no accident, boy. Maybe now you have some sense of the gravity, nay, the destiny of this moment. This is your birthright.
Golly, I don't know what to say.
Just say yes.
Hey, what's this one with the face?
Oh, that? Oh, no, 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 no. You're not ready to step into the court of the Crimson King. At this stage in your training, album like that could turn you into an evil scientist. Buckle your mind, Dean, because it's about to get blown.
I'm